Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pokemon Go has taken an old game, put it in the streets, and taken off like wildfire. Since its release Friday, the augmented reality smartphone app has been downloaded by millions of players who can now see through their phones virtual little Pokemonsters superimposed on the world around them, in streets, bars, buildings, anywhere. Arlington National Cemetery doesn't want it, neither does the Holocaust Museum in Washington. But it's all over. This hour, On Point, Pokemon Go and the future of augmented reality. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you seen people wandering around the streets looking through their phones for Pokemon? Are you out there yourself trying to catch them all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org. or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Go way back. There was a video game. There was a TV series. First premiered the series in 1998. In the first episode, the main character there, Ash Ketchum, meets his first Pokemon, Pikachu. Here's a clip of the iconic duo's electrifying first encounter.
Pikachu.
Its name is Pikachu.
Oh, it's so cute. It's the best of all.
You'll see.
Oh, hi, Pikachu.
Pika.
Okay, if that was electrifying for you, maybe you've been out in the streets since Friday trying to catch some of these Pokemon monsters. In New York on Tuesday, Pokemon Go player Xavier Rusan talked with the Wall Street Journal about his experience with his smartphone app out in the streets, looking through it, looking to it, looking for Pokemon monsters.
I've been, you know, walking around trying to get a Pokemon, and in the heat of the moment, I might, like, walk into a pool, like, I just kind of jerked a little bit to the right after I did. That's the worst that happened.
Walking into a pole could be worse. Later in this hour, we'll talk with Silicon Valley veteran Antonio Garcia Martinez about his new book, Chaos Monkeys, about tech world culture. But first to Pokemon Go. Joining me from Chicago is Paul Tassi. He covers video games, technology, and the internet for Forbes.com and is all over Pokemon Go. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Some of our listeners may be all over this themselves and out in the streets and racing around in cars looking for Pokemon. Others may have never heard of any of this. Where has it come from? How's it work?
The game itself uses GPS data from Google, and it plants landmarks and random monsters kind of all around the city or the area you live. And you can wander around in real life and throw Pokeballs at them to try and catch them.
The origin of this is in a game and show that dates back to the 90s. So how old would the cohort be who were might have been all wrapped up in this then?
Oh, man. I think the first games came out in 99. So that was Red and Blue. And so that, for me, that was junior high school. And so a lot of people kind of grew up playing these games. There have been many other Pokemon games released since, but I think a lot of people may not have played since the early days, but this is a way they can kind of get back into it.
So I've got one of my producer's smartphone in my hand right now, Sarah Platt's smartphone in my hand. She's downloaded the app. We've got it up, and there's a kind of cartoon-looking map of the very room I'm sitting in, the building I'm sitting in, and the room I'm sitting in, the studio right here. Her avatar, I guess, a sort of cartoon girl, is standing there, and we did a little bit of this earlier in the building this morning. Suddenly, there was a Pokemon character, monster, I don't know what you call them, showed up, and I began flicking balls at it, and I guess I captured a Fidgey or a Widgey. I don't remember what it was called, some funny name.
That'd be a Pidgey, yep.
Okay. When I tapped on it, suddenly I wasn't looking at a cartoon version anymore. I was looking at the actual interior of our office through, of course, the lens of the smartphone. And so there you go. The augmented reality of the cartoon character stayed in the picture that showed my actual studio and office.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. You can project Pokemon anywhere. I've seen him on sports fields, in beer glasses, on toilets. it's kind of all over the place where you can find him.
I'm told I caught a Weedle this morning. Whatever a Weedle is, how's the game work? How do you win? What's at stake here?
So it's tough to know what defines winning, but around the area, they're going to be kind of super landmarks called gyms. And if you catch enough Pokemon and you start leveling them up to make them powerful, you can battle with other teams. When you hit level 5, you pick either a red, blue, or yellow team, and then you kind of fight for territory. So if some other team owns a gym, you go with your Pokemon and you battle them and you try and kick them out of the gym and you take it over. So that's kind of how you win, but there's a lot of back and forth kind of trading with battling.
Okay, I do now, I can report, have in my studio, on my tabletop, a Widgie. And I on Pokemon Go, and I am now flicking this little ball job at this guy and see if I hit him with one of these balls, I guess he becomes part of my corral of creatures. That's the idea?
Yeah, the self-proclaimed goal of the game is to catch them all, and there are 150 in this space set, 151, and at least 146 of them are out in the wild somewhere, so that's why you see people kind of running around in the streets trying to catch ones they haven't seen yet or catch rare ones.
Well, I just did it. I just flicked a couple of balls, and I have caught a Weedle and a Pidgey today. That's pretty junior-level stuff, and I have to admit, we cheated. We used incense, whatever that is, to attract one of these to the studio just now. But you've got people out in the world. I mean, it's anywhere GPS reaches, they will sort of understand where you are. These will show up, and so people are running around looking. Things you have to look down at your phone to know if one of these cartoon characters is virtually in your vicinity. You can't just wait for a buzz. You really have to pay attention.
Yeah, it's a tiny bit dangerous. If once you learn kind of the sounds and the vibrations, you can just kind of have your headphones on and kind of know when stuff's nearby. But yeah, most people, the best way to do it is to constantly be looking at your phone to make sure you don't miss anything. But obviously, that has a couple dangerous implications.
Don't drive and do this, though people are doing it, and police are warning, be careful. James in Mount Juliet, Tennessee is calling. Hi, James, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom. First of all, Pidgeys are low level, but they're going to be great if you want to level up later, which I get the impression you won't.
All right, but I got a Pidgey now. I've got a Pidgey. Are you playing, James? Playing. Are you out there? Tell us.
Yeah, I'm 36. I play it with my 7-year-old daughter who's tried to get me to care about Pokemon for at least 2 years now, and I haven't. But it's also summer, and we're struggling to find things to do outside that are fun enough to warrant the heat.
Yeah.
And this is definitely one of those things, so that's really cool. It's getting us out when we would just be sitting inside in the air conditioning. And also, I'm seeing lots of people around town in places that there are not normally lots of people who are interacting in ways that I can tell that they weren't already familiar. And given the social climate of the last couple of weeks,
yeah,
I think that's especially powerful.
It does get you out. Where have you played? Where have you taken your smartphone and your app and played, James?
I went at 7 o'clock in the morning 3 days ago. I went to the state park up the street, which I had not been into in at least 6 months, and did a 2-mile walk searching for Pokemon. So I got exercise, which I don't normally do. And on the other side, tons of schools and churches and little trails that I didn't even know were around town. This is leading me to all sorts of landmarks that I had no idea were so close to me.
Getting people out in the world, James and his 7-year-old daughter. I hope you have fun with it, James. Paul, I mean, describe for us some of these so-called gyms. These are centers. I mean, the big one is St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, I think, but they're all over the place. And there have been protests from some destinations who don't want to be part of the virtual game. Arlington National Cemetery says, please don't come search for Pokemon here. The National Holocaust Museum saying, thanks, not even thanks, just no, this is wrong.
Yeah, some of these areas can be a little problematic between them being gyms and Pokestops, where Pokestops can give you items if you just stop by them.
So you'll have things you use to be a more effective Pokemon hunter or gatherer.
Yeah, they'll give you more balls and potions and things like that. But the problem is when it's someone's house or it's a really kind of sensitive landmark, that can be kind of troublesome. So I know Niantic, the developer, is working on ways to report, an inappropriate location, so I think they're going to start removing kind of more dangerous or inappropriate ones pretty soon.
Someone's house? People could start knocking at my door wanting to come in and pick up virtual Gigas to play?
There's a story of a guy who moved into an abandoned church, but the game didn't register that it was a home now, so his home essentially was a Pokestop, and people, like dozens of people, were coming to his house pretty much all day and like hanging out in front of his house. So he's attracted some news attention.
Paul, is this what augmented reality is about? I somehow had a grander vision of it than, but this is the thing that's attracted, millions of people into the fold.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's already the most popular mobile game in history, at least in the U.S., in like 5 days. So, I mean, this is kind of the grand unfolding of augmented reality. It marries this concept of Pokemon, which has this nostalgic factor, to, you know, a really good application of it where it works perfectly. Well, not perfectly, but it works with this concept well enough where it's very addicting and it's getting people to get outside and be social.
Is it a great augmented reality experience?
It is a better augmented reality experience than any other ones that I've played so far. The game is actually built on the bones of an older augmented reality game from the same developer called Ingress, and that attracted a decent amount of players, but they've used all that data for Pokemon now, and they've kind of created a better game because of it.
Google's role in this important, I guess, because they've got a lot of the data that lets the game integrate with the surroundings.
Yeah, exactly. So it's using Google Maps data, and the company, Niantic, who made the game, was actually, they spun out of Google itself. So that's how they have all this data for it.
Pokemon Go, all over the place right now. Paul Tassi has been playing in Chicago. Paul, thanks very much for being with us today. Terrific to have you. Safe playing.
You too.
Paul Tassi with Forbes.com covers video games, technology, the internet there. We're talking about Pokemon Go, the augmented reality game that has people chasing monsters all over real streets around the world through the screens of their cell phones. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pokemon! Zubat, Primeape, Meowth, Onix, Geodude, Rapidash, Magneton, Snorlax, Gengar, Tangela, Goldeen, Spearow, Weezing, Seal, Gyarados, Slowbro!
You wanna be a master of Pokemon? Do you have the skills to be number one? I wanna take the ultimate step, find the courage to be bold, Pokemon. To risk it all and not forget the lessons that I owe.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Pokemon Go, this augmented reality game that has people chasing Pokemon monsters all over real streets, into buildings, all over the place, all over the country, beyond, through the screens of their cell phones. Augmented reality, we're looking at where that may go next. You can join us this hour. Are you out there playing? Are you looking out for what's really around you as you play in the virtual world? What's the thrill? What's the appeal here? Is it nostalgia for childhood Pokemon days? Is it the excitement of having the monsters out in the streets? And what's next? What's coming for augmented reality? A little bit of music there from Pokemon World. That was the opening theme song for the English dub of the second season of the Pokemon cartoon. Now it's all back. Augmented reality out in the streets. People playing. If you're place of business becomes designated as a Pokemon gym or a Pokestop where virtual stuff is happening, can be a big deal. Here's Sarah Osiak, a bartender in Lakewood, Ohio, told ABC Local News that thanks to Pokemon Go, her bar has seen an uptick in business.
She bartends at a designated Pokemon Go gym. So she's not only sharing her love for the game with customers, she's also reaping the financial benefits of it.
But it's definitely increasing our business as we have lots of people coming through to do their Pokemon battles, grabbing great burgers, beers, winning their battles.
Kind of crazy. You would have no idea if you didn't have the app that this stuff is being projected around you. Since the release on Friday, reports of gamers becoming vulnerable, even vulnerable, some of them just not looking where they're going. Some for crime. Saturday night, Nicholas Howard was robbed at gunpoint in St. Louis after being lured to a checkpoint with the promise of Pokemon.
The app led Nicholas here to a popular checkpoint just across the street from the gas station. That's when he noticed a black BMW pull in silently behind him.
There were four kids inside. The kid in the back passenger seat had a silver pistol, and he got out of the car and put it in my face, told me to lose my stuff.
Lose your stuff. People playing all over, a lot of them with us right now. Braden calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Braden, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to say that this is a dream come true for me. Since I played my first Pokemon game, you wanted them to be real. You wanted them to be in the real world, and I'm having a blast with everyone in my city. It seems like every other person is playing it. But this morning, I woke up to a picture on Facebook of, I believe, a Civil War plaque, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that had been spray painted with one of the teams. So it had been graffitied and vandalized by one of the Pokemon teams, and not that it matters, but it was mine. And that just really set me off. And guys, this is for fun. This is a dream come true, so let's not ruin it. Let's keep it fun for everybody.
The meeting of augmented reality and a Civil War memorial there. Are you running all over the place, Braden, with your smartphone and finding and capturing and climbing?
Yes, sir. I go to the park just about every day for at least an hour and just walk around, and I meet 10-year-old kids and 50-year-old kids playing. So it's pretty crazy. I love it.
That's wild. Braden, thank you for your call. Renee in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Renee, you're on.
Hey, Tom. I want to agree with a lot of the callers. This has definitely been a social revolution. There have been so many times when my husband and I are out. We don't have children, but we go out and we walk miles a day, and there are people that I know that are 300 and 400 pounds that are trying to lose weight and having difficulty with that.
Yeah.
They're going out and walking the same amount of miles as us. And
if Pokemon Go is getting you walking, why are you walking so much with it? Explain how that works for people who don't play it.
Because you have your phone out, and like was mentioned previously, you don't have to focus on it the whole time. There's a battery saver option where you can turn your phone upside down, and the screen will go blank, but you'll still be able to hear the sounds, and it'll vibrate when a Pokemon is nearby, and then you can just check it as you're walking.
Okay.
But as you're walking, you also have eggs that are incubating to hatch new Pokemon. So in multiple ways, you go out and find the Pokemon to catch them, and then you're also hatching new eggs as you're walking.
And they only incubate effectively if you're walking. The GPS is tracking you, and if you're walking, the eggs are incubating, and you're going to have new creatures, new powers.
Yes, but you can't just get in a car and drive or a golf cart and drive. You have to actually be walking. You have to be under a certain speed for that to count.
Maybe better than a Fitbit right here with Pokemon. Renee, I really appreciate your call from Myrtle Beach. Gaia Dempsey joins us right now from Dublin, Ireland, joining us via Skype. She's co-founder, vice president of Daiquiri International. It's an American-based augmented reality company. Gaia, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So is this it? We've heard about virtual reality for such a long time, augmented reality where you don't have a headset on, but you're sort of out in the world. Is this the great unveiling at the popular level?
I think it is. It's a really exciting development for those of us in the AR industry because it enables a much more widespread level of visibility with consumers. It's a technology that's already well known in industry and, for instance, in medicine. It has a lot of use cases beyond, you know, in the gaming world, it's very fun. It's very cool. I think a lot of people are going to find out about it for the first time thanks to Pokemon Go. But a lot of its value is going to come from its ability to do knowledge transfer in the workplace, and eventually we'll see it in the classroom. We really believe that it has a place across the board in any situation where you need to communicate effectively.
I mean, I'm sitting here in the studio with Pokemon Go up on a smartphone, and I now have a wild Kakuna in the studio with me, and I can flick balls at it and I guess take it into my realm. How do you go from that to augmented reality enhancing education or information transfer?
So that's a great question. So right now, the experience that you're having is of a character, but imagine that you had an augmented reality experience that was teaching you about each of the different elements in the periodic table, for instance. And instead of just having the periodic table up on the wall, you had an augmented reality experience in front of you where you're seeing the color, the substance, the shape of each of the different chemicals. It allows your brain to interact with that content as if it's truly there, which activates the part of your brain that's responsible for spatial awareness. It allows you to learn faster and retain the information for longer. So that completely transforms the way that teachers can engage with their students in the classroom. And also, particularly as you get to more and more complex subjects, if you wanted to, for example, explain the inner workings of a complex machine, having an augmented reality experience that is interactive, that allows a learner to go at their own pace and explore all angles of the subject that they're learning, it makes a really big difference.
So I could sort of walk right into the molecular structure of some chemical as if it was floating in the room right with me.
Exactly.
Well, all I have at the moment, I just took this wild kakuna. I'm pretty boss at this game, I guess, but not exactly molecular structure or high chemistry. Guys, stand by there in Dublin with us right now from San Francisco, California. David Levitt, founder and CEO of Pantomime Corporation. They develop software, virtual reality software. David Levitt, my old friend, thank you very much for being with us. What do you think of this Pokemon Go sensation, David?
Hi, Tom. It's very exciting. It's opening this up to the entire world very quickly. And I think it's the beginning of a bridge between this virtual reality craze over the last 2 years that's really been for a relatively small elite and this much larger market of people who want to be able to interact and don't necessarily want to buy a special headset to do it.
David, talk to us more about the difference between virtual reality, which we've tend to associate with the big headset you put on with the big goggles in front of your eyes versus augmented reality for people who've never thought 2 seconds about either. What's the difference?
Well, virtual reality is the ability to see and reach into worlds, simulated worlds. Ordinarily it's associated with a head-mounted display that's got a stereo imagery like an animated... Mm-hmm. But the augmented reality has, in that context, is usually thought of a much more advanced, complex thing where you've got cameras attached to the headset that let you see in stereo the world that's really around you and mixes those images. So it's often thought of like there's a company called Magic Leap that's raised $1 billion to make the next generation of augmented reality that way. And in a way... Pokemon is doing an end run around that whole thing, and that's actually what Pantomime does too. Our company creates augmented and virtual reality worlds mm-hmm. that don't necessarily require a headset and that you can reach into and really decide which display you might be looking through. In a way, our perception of reality comes from consensus, and that's both more than one person seeing into a world and more than one display showing it. The same way that stereo makes you say, aha, that's real, two different displays in the room confirming that something is where it is tells you, ah, that's real. But they don't really have to be attached to your face. And in fact, that's kind of in some ways, certainly without augmented reality, that's been sort of an isolating aspect
mm-hmm,
of it.
Mm-hmm.
But Pantomime's approach is, oh, it could be on your PC or Mac screen. It could be on your tablet. You could be reaching in with your tablet or phone, very much like... our approach is a physically realistic approach where you can actually reach in and touch things with your iPad or it turns into a tool or your iPhone.
But the environment appears to be the environment that you are in with this augmentation on top or within it.
That's right. You have the rear-facing camera on the typical mobile device that lets you see that and then see things overlaid on top of it. Now, usually, you know, you can think of it as two kinds of augmented reality, a Terminator style or a Roger Rabbit style. The Terminator style isn't really interactive. It's about a layer of metadata between you and the things that you see in the physical world. The Roger Rabbit style is really where you reach in and interact with something substantively. And that's, you know, in a way, although it's very simple physically, that's what Pokemon Go is doing, and it's opening up this really exciting portal into the future.
Daniel in Miami, Florida. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. Are you playing?
Currently, no. But I am a big player. I'm 18 years old. And I just wanted to comment on what was really kind of an odd experience for me because although I'm younger among Pokemon players because I didn't play it, I was born when the first games were coming out. I was familiar with the franchise. I knew the characters. I had never been a big Pokemon fan, but Pokemon Go was something that I started playing pretty soon after it came out.
Like Friday.
Friday.
Okay.
I went to my local park because some people had placed some lures there, and all of a sudden, within 5 minutes, it was five teenagers from all the local schools in Miami, and we had friends in common. But the thing is, and what struck me is because I go biking pretty often, and I've been through that park, and never once have I seen more than two or three other teenagers in that park.
Yeah.
And what I think is really interesting is there's a lot of green space that often goes unused in cities,
yeah.
And that now Pokemon Go is driving people out, especially youth who just aren't used to it. I mean, we're the digital natives. We've been used to playing electronic games indoors, and now there's an opportunity to explore our outside world while still being in touch with the games that we were raised with.
Daniel, do it, Daniel, and have fun, and be careful if you're on your bike when you're doing it. But I really appreciate your call. I mean, Gaia, is it all social, Gaia? The character that I see through my producer's Pokemon Go app here is the same one that you'll see if we're in the same space?
That's actually, Tom, one of the kind of benefits about augmented reality that separates it from virtual reality is that it is more social. Instead of being isolated and locked into a world that only you can see, your head is up. You are looking forward. You can make eye contact. You can have that digital information, and you can have a shared experience. And you know, to the point that a lot of the callers are making, that brings you out into the real world instead of further isolating you in a digital world. It's a concept, you know, it's a very intuitive evolution of digital media. It's something that's been widely depicted in fiction for a long time, mm-hmm. from literature to movies. You can think of Star Wars, the classic Princess Leia. You can think of Iron Man, The Hunger Games, Avatar. There's augmented reality now. You can turn on the television and it's in, you know, advertising. It's everywhere. So it's a very, very, it's a very intuitive kind of way that we as humans want to interact with digital information and bring that into the real world. You know, an AR system at its core is very simple. You need to have a camera. You need to have a tracking mechanism of some kind, whether that's GPS and just using your position on the map, or whether you're actually optically tracking the world and mapping the geometry and inserting content in a way that has a relationship to that physical map of the world. And then obviously you need to have processing. You need to be able to compute the data. And then that system can either be handheld, as in the case of the Pokemon Go game, or it can be wearable. And that's what we at Daiquiri focus on is, you know, we really believe that one of the pillars of the future of augmented reality is that it will evolve into being a medium that is primarily experienced in a wearable form factor.
Like through eyeglasses or some kind of eyepiece, perhaps.
Exactly, yeah. Our flagship product is actually a smart helmet. And right now it's implemented in industrial work environments. So it helps workers improve their safety and their efficiency. It benefits companies by creating cost savings, by doing things like providing augmented work instructions and augmented reality data visualization. So you can do things like provide safety alerts and put team members in better communication and actually bring in the digital information that's important to their work and have it right there in front of them when they're making decisions or potentially working in a hazardous environment such as a nuclear facility or a manufacturing environment.
We've got people calling from all over in Columbia, Missouri. Jody is worried about her 11-year-old chasing these things around, doesn't know where he's going to end up. I mean, David, do you think that eventually if people start having this built into their eyeglasses or the just somehow the augmentation shows up in front of them, does regular reality become boring, become flat compared to vistas full of digital stuff moving and hopping and turning and twirling, David?
Well, it can certainly be distracting. You know, that's always been the claim about virtual reality since VPL research created in the 90s, and it's been oversold up until now, but definitely you can see that people are tripping over themselves and potentially injuring themselves and so on. So it's so in this new form factor, there's concern at that level. I think the fact that people are more interesting than robots in most ways means that that's not going to happen as quickly as people fear, but just the physical issues that are brought to light by Pokemon Go mean we have to deal with it now. I think the idea that everyone will be wearing glasses soon to experience these things is actually a much slower process. And really, virtual and augmented reality in a handheld form factor, seeing a virtual world on your Mac or PC, seeing it through a tablet and interacting that way will be much more common.
More likely right now. David, we're out of time right there. I really appreciate your being with us. David Levitt, founder and CEO of Pantomime Corporation, with us from San Francisco. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks, Tom.
And Gaia Dempsey, co-founder at Daqri International, with us from Dublin, Ireland today. Gaia, we're amazed. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we talk with Silicon Valley veteran Antonio Garcia Martinez about his new book, Chaos Monkeys. This is On Point. Be the best that you can.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Antonio Garcia Martinez knows Silicon Valley very well, and he's done well there inside Facebook, Twitter, and more. Now he's written a kind of tell-all about the Silicon Valley people and culture that are turning so much of the world upside down. His new book is called Chaos Monkeys. You can join us on air or online. Where's Silicon Valley taking us? With me now from San Francisco is Antonio Garcia Martinez, former product manager for Facebook, author of the new book, Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Antonio, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What's the idealized version of Silicon Valley, and what's the version you're bringing us here?
Right. I think the idealized version is one where, meritocracy rules and the smartest, hardest working person wins. I think the reality that everyone inside Silicon Valley actually knows, but I think people outside maybe don't know, is that things like luck, happenstance, being the first mover, or sometimes even the last mover, is actually, you know, what determines who wins and loses in Silicon Valley.
Chaos monkeys. What are we talking about?
Just imagine a wild monkey rampaging through a large computer center, kicking over boxes and pulling on cables. That's the image you need to have in mind. In fact, there's a piece of software called the Chaos Monkeys that was built by Netflix, and it's a way that they test how well their computers can actually serve you, say, House of Cards. In the case of this book, what I meant is sort of metaphorically, and what I mean by this is Silicon Valley right now is sort of like the zoo where the chaos monkeys are kept. And they run around society and they pull the plug on things like taxis, and they ship an app called Uber where anyone can become a taxi driver. Or they pull the plug on hotels, and anyone with a spare bedroom or a weekend cottage can suddenly become an innkeeper. And so Silicon Valley right now is basically rampaging through society and pulling the plug on a lot of traditional industries. And the question is, how robust are we to Silicon Valley as a society?
What do you mean by how robust are we?
Well, what I mean by that is, you know, what happens when every New York taxi driver, every Boston taxi driver is basically out of a job or is competing with a mass of people anyone who can actually become a taxi driver, you know, or what happens, for example, I wrote part of the book in Barcelona, mm-hmm. and Barcelona is Airbnb's largest real estate market. And literally almost every house in certainly every building in the touristy parts of town had become basically Airbnb hotels and had completely disrupted life and had completely warped the real estate market, right? So all of a sudden one day, you live in Barcelona and this app from somewhere in San Francisco just completely roils your real estate market. And how do you deal with that, right? That's what I mean by robustness. I mean, it's when the chaos monkeys visit, it's a question of, you know, is your life going to be the same before and after?
The ideology out of Silicon Valley is that what comes here is innovation, inventiveness, efficiency, and with that, a kind of goodness. But you say the world of Silicon Valley is populated with sociopaths. So which is it?
Well, I mean, you can take a certain Adam Smith invisible hand take on it, even if it is populated by sociopaths, mm-hmm. which I think it is. The net effect can actually still be very good. I mean, the reality is every new technology, whether it be credit derivatives or whether it be mobile apps, is often misused initially, right? And we're seeing some of that with, for example, Facebook, in which we've had horrific crimes or even police brutality, live streamed on Facebook. But on the other hand, you know, we're connecting all over the world through Facebook as well.
So how do sociopaths get drawn to Silicon Valley. That's a pretty strong word for people who probably see themselves as, I don't know, heroic, explorers of the future who bring it home.
I'm sure they see themselves that way. And obviously, I'm not a trained psychologist, but the personality traits, and I embody them myself, by the way. I should mention, I'm as frank about my own life in the book as I am with everyone else's. The sort of glib, persuasive charm that's very superficial, the ability to turn on a dime and manipulate people, a love of risk, both physical, sexual promiscuity, lots of other personality traits that are basically the textbook definition of sociopathy. I saw embodied not only in my own life, in those of an entire cohort of entrepreneurs who are building companies. And yeah, I think it's definitely part of the makeup here.
Is it evolving? I mean, Silicon Valley is not brand new anymore by any means. Where are we in that evolution of Silicon Valley?
Yeah, no, I think it definitely is evolving. And I think part of the sort of public opinion of Silicon Valley is a little bit dated. You know, in early Silicon Valley, we're talking the 80s and the 90s, it was sort of countercultural. It was the hippies. It was the flower children. It was the sort of Steve Jobs mold of, the guy who had dropped out and was going up against the man, right? I think the image now is a lot more hard-edged. I think it's a lot more libertarian. It's a lot more just, you know, get out of my way while I do my thing. And nobody, whether it be culture or institutions or government, should get in the way of my new idea. It's a lot more winner take all, and it's a lot more sort of tooth and nail than it has been in the past, I think.
What was it like for you? You had a company called AdGrok. I guess Facebook bought it, and that sucked you into the world of Facebook. What did you find?
Well, it was even more complicated than that, actually. So we raised a little bit of money. We ran for 10 months, and despite having no real customers and no real revenue, we sold for about $10 million to Twitter, actually. And then one of the dramas of the book is that I bail on the Twitter deal and actually go to Facebook. And so I landed at Facebook a year before the IPO, and I was part of the team that basically built how Facebook monetizes itself. If some of your listeners, for example, go and browse the internet and they look at products on Amazon or whatever, and they go back to Facebook and they see that inside their Facebook experience, I actually built that, the first version of that at Facebook.
You say, as a Facebook product manager, quote, you resembled an Afghan warlord or pirate captain, fearsome in appearance to outsiders, the scourge of entire companies and industries, but actually barely in control of your small band of engineer hooligans and always one step away from mutiny. What?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So just clarify here, the product manager, in short, is sort of the CEO of the product. He's the face of the product to the external world. He's the sort of product visionary who's trying to guide the team in one direction. And as the joke was inside Facebook, he's the man with or woman with all the responsibility but none of the authority, because the engineers don't actually report to that product manager in the organization chart. And so it was this weird duality that to the outside world, I officially my title was product manager of ads targeting. I was literally in charge with turning Facebook user data into money by giving advertisers tools to track you. And so, of course, to the outside world, I had a position of immense power, not due to my own personal sway or anything, of course. It's because I could control the 800-pound gorilla living in everyone's bed that's called Facebook. So, of course, inside the company, it was a question of constantly rallying the engineers and constantly defending that vision to senior management. I often said that, you know, it was harder actually being at Facebook than doing a startup, because in a startup, you raise money once and then you work for a year, while at Facebook, you were constantly pitching and trying to convince people as to the sort of, you know, the truth of your cause.
Give us some of the Chaos Monkey stories about how things roll, how things unfold.
Well, if you just want some of the interior gossip, let's see. So I was living on a boat at the time at Facebook, and I like homebrewing. I'm into craft beer. I've gotten to the craft beer thing. And so, of course, what do? I move my homebrew setup to Facebook. And come one evening when we were having what's called a hackathon, when everyone hacks on a random project at night, I decide to brew beer, whereupon, upon cooling the beer, I blow up the plumbing and flood Mark Zuckerberg's desk with water. And that's just an example of what it was like in my relatively early days of Facebook, when you can sort of get away with that. Another piece of chaos, when we moved to the new sort of large corporate campus that now has a Frank Gehry building and all this business, it was Mark's idea to basically give everyone as much spray paint and paint as they wanted to decorate the walls, because there was always this thing about graffiti at Facebook. Yeah. And his brilliant idea was say, well, just go and create art. And of course, it was sort of as if you had filmed Lord of the Flies inside the paint section of a Home Depot. Everyone ran absolutely riot. And Mark actually had to literally walk down every hallway with blue masking tape and mark out what he wanted deleted. And he gave us a horrible sort of preachy email about having vandalized corporate headquarters.
How do we see, does the chaos sometimes show through? I mean, what we end up with is fairly shiny products, often, you know, with software glitches and all the rest, but it ends up pretty tidy and presented to us on the outside. Have you seen moments when the kind of chaos behind the screen became visible to all?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, this is what I call the narrative fallacy, right? Which is the human brain wants, if events A, B, and C happen, the human brain wants some causal connection between them. Mm-hmm. The reality is this. This is how Silicon Valley actually works. And anybody inside of Facebook would say the same. You launch 10 products, 7 utterly fail and are swept under the rug and never spoken about again. 2 succeed mostly for the reasons you thought. And then 1 goes absolutely gangbusters for reasons that only make sense in retrospect. So for example, you know, Facebook now is worth over $300 billion and its stock price has quadrupled since I've left. Why is that? It was due basically to putting ads in your mobile feed. And that wasn't even imagined as the savior of the company at the time when I left in 2013. We were discussing all sorts of other things around data joining, et cetera. But that ended up being the savior of the company, you know, in somewhat random fashions for that, you know, that we didn't really expect. And so, you know, after the fact, you present this direct causal link between, you know, visionary product leadership and steely-eyed execution. Yeah. But the reality is that behind the scenes, there's a lot of flailing and foundering going on.
How has all the money changed Silicon Valley? I mean, there's been a fair bit for a while, but it's just grown. The values have just grown. How's it changed the culture or what comes out of Silicon Valley?
Well, I'm not sure if you're referring to the prices of the companies or real estate, but those two numbers are highly related.
So, yes. Okay. So it drives real estate prices up. That's obvious and simple. I wonder about what it produces and how people interact and how they see the world when there's so much money around.
I think what you're seeing actually is a real two-tier society. And in San Francisco, this is one of the burning issues of the day. For example, I present the image in the book, which is, you know, you could walk out right now in San Francisco and see it. There's a street called 24th and Valencia, which is sort of a trendy part mm-hmm. of what's called the Mission, which is the hip part of San Francisco. And it's a bus stop for the Muni, which is a local transport system. And of course, Muni has its normal sort of ramshackle bus kind of lurching along. And then you have these wonderful corporate shuttles carting off the residents of the city, you know, down to Silicon Valley to the offices and back. And you literally have, you know, almost a two-tier system of citizenship. You have the techies who are living one way and you have everyone else who is living very much another. And I should note, and that's also happening in the context of a real homeless problem, actually, in San Francisco. So it's funny because I didn't write this book in San Francisco, but I've been coming back every 3 to 6 months. And every 3 months, it just gets worse and worse. And we're at the point where basically every highway overpass in San Francisco and Oakland has a shanty town, a tent city underneath it that's there basically permanently. Meanwhile, once again, Wi-Fi enabled tech shuttles are sort of driving by in complete blissful ignorance of that reality.
So square these pictures for us. On the one hand, Silicon Valley is presented and appears to be, in many ways, a great national resource for the United States, an outcome of a particular kind of culture and finance, venture capital that's been incredibly fecund in coming up with new products and new ways of doing and disrupting. On the other hand, you raise the question of whether the United States itself is robust enough to survive this valley of creativity. How's that all fit together?
You know, that's a great question. And I feel it's almost a question above my pay grade. That's, you know, something that's hopefully somebody in the White House is thinking about. I mean, the response to that argument or that concern that the typical Silicon Valley person would say, and they use it to justify everything, basically. And that's, well, it's inevitable, right? I mean, technology has its inevitable course. You're just standing in the way of it. I mean, this is, you know, it's almost this sort of technical manifest destiny in that, no, this needs to be created. And, you know, the chips may fall where they may, and this is going to, I mean, taxis were going to go away no matter what. It doesn't matter that, you know, there's a whole – or that, for example, even mm-hmm. bigger, truck driving, right? I mean, consider yep. what will happen to truck drivers when autonomous vehicles are standard. And that's going to happen –
Self-driving vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, self-driving vehicles. That's going to happen in 10 years. And if you look at a map, actually, there's this amazing map of the most popular job in every U.S. state. Mm-hmm. And I forget what it is, but for a large number of U.S. states, truck driving is actually the most common profession. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's the one way that a you know, non-college educated
yep.
person
make a living.
Can put food on the
work,
table.
You can make a living.
Right, and that's going to go away in 10 years. That's not going to exist as a job in 10 years, and nobody is thinking about that. And I think that's going to be a real problem down the line. Actually,
we've heard Peter Thiel and others say, but Peter Thiel in particular, PayPal founder among other things, co-founder, that Silicon Valley has lost its mojo; that it doesn't really come up with big innovations anymore. Do you agree with that?
You know, it's sort of, he has a famous quote that's quite clever, so I'll quote it, that says, you know, we were promised flying cars and we got 140 characters on Twitter, right? So there's, you know, this whole Jetson age never quite got realized. And instead, we're engaging in this sort of orgy of narcissism, right? Like, instead of flying cars, we have the selfie stick. And what does that mean? Mm-hmm. I agree with him that, in fact, there's a lot of money chasing maybe not terribly great ideas. But I look at it this way. Consider somebody like Elon Musk that I think inarguably is actually doing, you know, interesting stuff, space exploration and the next generation of transportation, right? And if you have to create this massive ecosystem of ridiculous, you know, hipsters working on social apps to produce one Elon Musk, then for society, it's probably worth it at the end of the day.
Is there a vision? Is there a shared vision of where all this goes that you could articulate that shows up sort of over beers in Silicon Valley when people feel like getting meta?
No, I think that high level philosophy was gone. I think in the days, I mean, I'm not old enough to have worked in Silicon Valley then, but from what one reads, in the days of the flower children and the whole Earth catalog and you know, Steve Jobs,
Stuart
et cetera,
Brand and Steve Jobs,
right? Stuart Brand, right? That whole vision of like techno hippieism, I think, did have a guiding philosophy. I think right now there isn't one, and I think the conversations and the people having those conversations right now in Silicon Valley are probably not terribly different than the sort of people you'd see in Boston in a consulting gig or in New York on Wall Street. It's the same sharky attitude, and it's the same ambition fired by maybe a little bit too much money that you'd see in any one of those other markets.
So if there's no overall guiding vision, maybe it never guided in the first place, but maybe there was one. If it's chaos monkeys just doing their thing, where do we end up?
Well, I in the book, I quote the famous quote by Marc Andreessen, who's one of the sort of more visionary venture capitalists in Silicon Valley. He says, in the future, there'll be two types of jobs. You either tell the computer what to do or you're told by the computer what to do. And I think that's going to be the reality for a large swath of the economy. You know, what happens in that world, I think, is a real question. At least in Silicon Valley, solutions like a universal basic income, for example, are becoming very popular because I think people in Silicon Valley realize, you know, there's just not going to be jobs for a lot of people in this economy in within 10 to 20 years.
You're out on your boat in San Francisco Bay these days. Are you still with a hand in Silicon Valley? Or are you finished with all that?
I do advise a couple of companies. I don't work full time in tech. You know, towards the end of the book, not to give a spoiler, my mother died, and I sort of constructed a bucket list of what I wanted to do, as one does when one confronts mortality. Yeah. One was publishing the book that we're talking about, and the other was crossing an ocean on a boat. And so right now, I'm going to spend the next 2 years of my life doing that last bucket list item. And after that, we'll see.
With Silicon Valley far behind, Antonio Garcia Martinez's book is Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. Antonio, thank you very much for being with us today. Fun talking with you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. Takes a lot of people with help from Ashley Bailey, Sarah Ernst, Dina Kleiner, and Tanya Rowley. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.